I'm Mary Bartow. I am an alum of the Peabody Conservatory. So we always sort of think we got into Hopkins through the back door, but we're very glad we got there. And this morning, I want to welcome everyone. We are very, very privileged to have with us Dr. Jonathan Bagger. He is a vice provost and the Krieger Eisenhower Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Johns Hopkins University. He attended Dartmouth College, Cambridge University, and Princeton University, where he received his PhD in 1983. He did his postdoctoral research at Stanford University, and from 1986 through 1989, he was the associate professor, associate professor at Harvard University. Dr. Bagger has twice been a member of the Institute for the Advanced Study in Princeton. He held a Sloan Fellowship, Foundation Fellowship, and the National Science Foundation Presidential Young Investigator Award. He was elected a member of the Space Telescope Institute Council and served on the Farrelab Board of Overseers, the National Research Council Board on Physics and Astronomy, and the Executive Board of the American Physical Society. He is also on the editorial board of two prestigious publications, the Physics Reports and the Journal of High Energy Physics. He is a fellow of the American Association for Advanced Science, and his research centers on high-energy physics at the interface between theory and experiment. He's written over 100 research papers, and we are delighted to have with us today Dr. Jonathan Bagger.
Well, so thank you very much for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for coming out today on such a beautiful day and to sit in the dark room. I don't know. If the people in the back can't see at any time, please come forward. We have some extra seats up here. This is a long and skinny room, and it's hard to see. Anyway, today I am here to tell you a little bit about cosmology, the Hubble Space Telescope, and to set the stage for your visit to the Rose Center. Now, the subject of modern cosmology is one that really touches us all. It asks deep questions, as symbolized by the Gauguin painting. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? But today, in the last decade, these questions are moving from the realm of art and philosophy to the area of science and popular culture. For example, we now know that our universe began in a big bang, a tremendous explosion, 13.7 billion years ago. And I really mean it. We know 0.7. It's become that accurate. And that fact is celebrated, in fact, in the Rolling Stones' latest album, The Biggest Bang. But it's also showing up all over the place. For example, on TV, on Tuesday nights in Baltimore, there's a show called The Big Bang Theory. I don't know if anybody here watches TV or watches that show. And I want you to keep your ears peeled as I play its introduction here.
The universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, and it grew the autotrophs, began to grow the end. All the developers, we built a wall, we built a pyramid. Science, history, unraveling the mystery, it all started with a big bang.
So if you really had your ears peeled, they had it right. Almost 14 billion years ago, the universe started indeed with a big bang, and they even had E equals mc squared flash by very quickly. But today, and at the Rose Center, we'll begin to explore a little bit the history of our universe. And this is really a story that stretches the human imagination. Very hard to conceptualize, because it involves physics that ranges from the very, very small to the very, very large. From the size, well, a billionth of a billionth of a meter, deep, deep, deep inside the atomic nucleus, all the way out to 100 trillion trillion meters, the size of the visible universe today. Now, a typical scale on Earth is the size of, well, something on Manhattan, a few kilometers. And if you imagine looking out to the size of the universe, that's a huge distance. The size we're looking inwards, that's part of this story, is the equivalent distance looking down deep inside the atom. And so we have a huge, huge range spanning many, many orders of magnitude. And as I mentioned before, this is a story that has passed from science fiction to science fact in the past decade or so. And in my opinion, it will go down as one of the great triumphs of the modern era. For example, just in 2006, WMAP, a satellite located far out in space, whose mission is actually being led by a principal investigator, Charles Bennett, in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Johns Hopkins, that satellite received information from the first trillionth of a second after the start of the universe. But today, I'm going to start the story a little bit later, just a picosecond after the start of the universe. That's a millionth of a second after the Big Bang. And at that time, the universe was much smaller than it is today. It was right after the explosion, and so the universe was very hot and very dense. And it was filled with all sorts of particles that were zooming along, hitting each other, colliding, scattering. These particles at that time had a trillion volts of energy each. Now, you know what happens with 100 volts. That's what you feel when you stick your finger in the socket. Don't do that. Imagine a trillion volts. So these particles had a huge amount of energy. And what they did was they banged into each other and in the process created new particles, all by this famous Einstein equation, E equals mc squared. They had a lot of energy, and so they made particles, new particles with a lot of mass, and things were sort of in equilibrium in a cosmic soup. And this cosmic soup was really quite a strange world, very different than our world today. And it's governed by some combination of Einstein's relativity and quantum mechanics, which are really the twin pillars of 20th century physics. So to understand what the ingredients of that cosmic soup really are, you have to go into the laboratory, make these particles here on Earth, study their properties, and then see how they fit into the expansion history of the universe. And so this is really the first such accelerator. These particles are made and accelerated to energies by these accelerators. This was the Brookhaven Cosmotron from the 1950s, located out at the end of Long Island. And in this nice accelerator fits in the room here, and it basically accelerated protons up to maybe a billion volts of energy and collided them into things, and you saw what happened. And a spray of new particles came out, particles that, again, only existed in the early universe. One of those particles that was created is called the Eta. That's the Greek letter Eta. And it's there because it was discovered by a group of researchers from Johns Hopkins. And the Greek letter Eta, for those who know, is actually a lowercase h. And so when you hear about the Eta, if you ever hear about the Eta, you know where it's got its name. So today, these particle accelerators have grown tremendously. This is currently the largest accelerator in the world. It's about 2 or 3 miles around in circumference, and it reaches a trillion volts of energy. This accelerator, Fermilab, is located in the western suburbs of Chicago. It's open to the public. If you're ever driving around out there, stop by. They'd be glad to see you, show you around. And what they have inside this ring is a huge number of superconducting magnets, which accelerate protons going one direction and antiprotons going the other direction, matter and antimatter. And they collide inside particle detectors in a spray of particles, creating new particles that have only been seen, that have last existed right after the Big Bang. So these are machines for taking energy and making mass, E equals mc squared. And inside the spray of particles coming out, which are detected in these fantastic particle detectors, physicists can actually figure out what is going on at those very short distances at those very high energies. And this is a picture of the CDF detector at Fermilab, which Johns Hopkins researchers are using to do this sort of science. And what we know now, after these decades of effort, is what the periodic table of the elements looked like at that picosecond after the Big Bang. So you all know the periodic table you learned in chemistry, or have some remembrance of what that is. This is the periodic table of the elementary particles. And we know that all matter, then, is made out of things called quarks, up quarks and down quarks, charm quarks and strange quarks, top quarks and bottom quarks, and leptons, electrons, then their partners mus and taus, and associated neutrinos. Now, you and I and everything in this room are really made up of up quarks and down quarks and electrons. And all these other quarks are produced at these accelerators. Heaven knows why they're there, but they are there. And we also know that this is it, as far as the quarks go, and their associated leptons. And then they are also held together by forces as well. Photons for the electromagnetic force, W's, Z's, and gluons for the nuclear forces, and then gravitons for energy. And so that's what the periodic table looks like. Those are the ingredients of the cosmic soup, a picosecond after the Big Bang. And so we can then trace forward the history from that picosecond. We have our quark soup, but as the universe cools and expands, well, just like steam turns to water, steams to ice, as it goes to ice as it cools, the universe changed too. And as the universe expanded and cooled, it went from a quark soup to, after 100 microseconds, the quarks bound up and became protons and neutrons. Then as the universe continued to cool, after 100 seconds after the Big Bang, the protons and the neutrons themselves turned into nuclei, the centers of atoms. And then the universe continued to expand and cool until it reached about 3,000 degrees, at which point, dang, I keep pushing the wrong button. 100,000 years after the Big Bang, atoms themselves formed. Now, the formation of these atoms, 100,000 years after the Big Bang, the atoms are neutral. It produced photons, it produced light, which then just streamed through the universe. But since the atoms are neutral, the light didn't interact with anything, and it's just been expanding with the universe ever since that moment. And then as the universe expanded and cooled, these photons went from having an energy of about 3,000 degrees Kelvin all the way down to 2.728 degrees. 2.728 degrees above absolute zero, the temperature that they exist at today. So these photons are still out there lurking in the universe, waiting to be detected. And that is actually what WMAP saw. The existence of these remnant photons left over from the Big Bang was predicted in 1948 by Ralph Alpher, who was working at the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins while he was getting his PhD from George Washington. At the time, people just thought this was absolutely crazy, that there was no way you could go into outer space and find these cold photons flying around left over from the Big Bang. And so people didn't pay a huge amount of attention. But now, today, we have the technology to do that, and we have done that. And here, in fact, is a picture taken by the WMAP satellite showing this afterglow of the Big Bang. It's really a baby picture of the universe, infant universe, which is more or less equivalent to me when I was 2 days old. So if I'm the age of the universe, it's back to me at about 2 days old. And as you look at this picture of the universe, it contains a lot of blobs. Basically, the red spots are a little hotter and the blue spots are a little colder. What you're really looking at is the fluctuations in the temperature. These are fluctuations that are about 1 part in 10 million in the temperature. So these are tiny fluctuations in a temperature about 3 degrees above absolute zero. But the pattern, the size, the shape, the distribution of these fluctuations actually gives us information about what was going on 100,000 years after the Big Bang. And so you can look at this and work backwards to figure out what were the real ingredients of the universe at that time. And what we've learned in the last 10 years is that the universe is a very different place than we imagined. We particle physicists are very proud that we've measured all these quarks and learned about them and discovered many of their properties. But what the cosmologists have told us is that atoms, the stuff made up of quarks, is only 4% of the stuff of the universe, and 96% is something else. This something else doesn't shine, it's dark, so it's called dark matter and dark energy. The difference is that dark matter, this 22% made out of dark matter is like regular matter in that it has regular gravity, it gravitates. In fact, dark matter is what seeded the formation of galaxies. It clumped, and then the light matter fell into the gravitational potential of that dark matter. So dark matter is not quarks, but it's sort of like matter. It's dark. You can understand it. And 74% is something completely different, dark energy. We don't know very much about it. It seems to fill the universe kind of like a fluid, but it's a very strange fluid in that it gravitationally repels, because the expansion rate of the universe is actually accelerating, not decelerating, and it's due to this presence of this very strange stuff called dark energy, which is actually the major amount of stuff today in the universe. And so one of the huge questions in science has become, over the last decade, what is this dark matter and this dark energy? So the astronomers have told us that dark matter exists for other reasons too. Here's a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope, and it shows what Einstein predicted, something called a gravitational lens. Because if you have a lot of matter here and light behind it, as the light comes to us and it goes around the big clump of matter, it actually gets bent. That's one of the predictions of relativity, that mass bends light. And so this is a picture of a gravitational lens, and there's a galaxy back here, and there's multiple copies of that galaxy around it. And given the distribution and size of the multiple images of the background galaxy being lensed by a foreground galaxy, you can actually calculate how much mass is needed to do the lensing. And you can look at how much you can see, how much is light, how much is made up of ordinary stars, and so forth. And you see it's nowhere near enough. There has to be more stuff, more matter, more dark matter, and they've seen it indirectly through these gravitational lenses with the Hubble Space Telescope. Here's a beautiful picture in my mind, created by Holland Ford, a professor in physics and astronomy, Rick White from the Space Telescope Science Institute, and James G., a graduate student at Hopkins. And they took this left-hand picture with the Hubble Space Telescope. And this picture on the left contains many, many, many of these tiny little gravitational lenses, so small you can't see them on the projection I'm showing here. And they worked backwards and said, okay, to explain all these lenses, how much dark matter do you need? And so what they did was to calculate the distribution of dark matter and then make the dark matter light and have it glow purple. And so the right-handed picture actually is the same as the left-handed picture, with the dark matter turned on and glowing purple. Now you can see that purple is, well, it's clumped kind of like the light, but it's actually very different. It's not in these little galaxies, it's much more diffuse. And this, in my opinion, is real visible evidence that the dark matter really is not like the light matter. Here's another picture, a composite picture taken for the images from the Magellan Telescope, the Hubble Telescope, and an X-ray telescope, Chandra, showing two galaxies that have collided with each other. Now, a galaxy has dark matter in the middle with and light matter together, dark matter and light matter together. And what has happened is these two have collided with each other. The dark matter has kept going, but the light matter, because it interacts with photons and light and so forth, has actually interacted and gotten all jumbled up. And so in this picture, you can see the difference. The dark matter has gone to the right and to the left, shown in blue, and the visible matter is all jumbled up in the middle. And so it again shows that galaxies really are filled with this dark matter, with light matter inside it, and they have different properties, and you can see it dynamically in the picture of these two galaxies that have run into each other and affected each other's motion in that way. Which brings us then to the story of what is this dark matter that fills our galaxy and every galaxy. Which again takes us back to the laboratory, this time not to Fermilab outside to Chicago, but to CERN, the International Laboratory of Particle Physics, really the European Laboratory of Particle Physics, outside Geneva. Because at CERN, a new accelerator will be starting up this fall, which should be able to produce the dark matter. So CERN is famous, of course, for this accelerator, and in a few weeks it will also be famous as the scene of much malfeasance from the movie Angels and Demons. That's coming out, and we can talk about that too. But this is the accelerator at CERN, which is called the Large Hadron Collider. It's about 16 miles around. It straddles the French-Swiss border. If you look very closely at this picture here, you can find Geneva Airport. It's probably that. Those are the runways to give you a size of the scale of this accelerator. It's about 100 meters underground, goes for much of its way. And in it, there's a tunnel, again, just like before. You see the radius of curvature. This is one monstrous tunnel. It's hardly curving at all. And in that, they will be colliding protons against protons, not with a trillion volts of energy, but with close to 10 trillion volts of energy each. So this is a way more powerful accelerator than exists at Fermilab. And one of the goals of this accelerator is to produce and measure the properties of these dark matter particles in the laboratory. Here's one of the detectors. There's two main detectors. This is the one that the Johns Hopkins researchers are working on, one called CMS. This is a picture of it under construction. And this is one monstrous machine. Here we have a picture of it. Well, first of all, you see that it weighs about as much as 7747s. It was constructed on the surface and then lowered down a shaft 100 meters below the surface into position. There was about this much space on each side as it was being lowered down the shaft. The wonderful thing about YouTube is you can actually go find a video and watch them lowering it with an interview with the guy who was in charge of it, making sure that it didn't hit the sides and didn't drop. But they actually did it. And the other thing about this YouTube is you can actually get a video here of that gives some picture of what it looks like, what this machine actually looks like. And so what it really is, well, it's got a whole lot of different kinds of detectors running around away from a collision point. So as that shower of particles comes out, you can begin to understand what actually was produced in that collision. So here's a sample collision simulated from CMS. And it has a lot of stuff in it that needs to be understood. Now, the CMS detector has about 1 million channels of information that it's reading out. So for every collision, it produces a megabyte of data. There are 100 million collisions a second. So this thing is producing 100 million megabytes, 100 million megabytes of information every second. And there is no way to record all that. That's about the equivalent of what everything in the entire world's telecommunication system. And so what these things really are is huge special purpose computers that in real time are analyzing what's going on inside the collision event, deciding, is this interesting, is this not interesting? If it's not interesting, they chuck it out. If it is interesting, they keep it. And so we've gone from having to collect, they keep maybe 100 events a second. So this initially has 100 million CDs worth of information every second being produced. And instead they save 100 CDs a second. Even that is quite a job, to be flipping those CDs in and out. No, that's not how they do it. But and still, it's still too much data to analyze. So those huge databases are actually distributed around the world through a grid of computing power, and a little bit is done at each university around the world harnessing that power, because there was no way that CERN could even have afforded to buy all the computers to analyze this data. And so by pushing the information out, people can buy their own computers, they work together to analyze this tremendous information flow. So this is just, I'm not an experimentalist, but I tip my hat to the job they're doing. And we hopefully will soon know something about the makeup of this dark matter. In the last minute, let me talk about dark energy. Dark energy was the third piece of that pie of the ingredients of the universe today. It dominates the universe today. 74% of the stuff of the universe is this dark energy. And it was first discovered by astronomers looking at supernovae, that is, exploding stars. And these stars explode in a particular way, and they can use them as standard candles, looking back into the past history of the universe and watch how these stars are exploding at farther and farther back in time. And what they could use then is, what they can do with those stars then, was to measure the rate of acceleration of the universe. And what they expected to see, we had an explosion, right? And everything is exploding out. But because it's gravitating, things should be slowing down as it expands, right? Because they're all pulling back in because they attract to each other by gravity. Instead, what they found was that the expansion rate is accelerating. So it's being pushed apart by this mysterious substance called dark energy. This was discovered by two groups. One group in California, led by Saul Perlmutter, and another group led by Brian Schmidt and Adam Riess. And Adam Riess is also now in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Hopkins. And here actually is Riess's lab book from the fall of 1997. It's too hard to see for people in the back. But what he calculates here is that without dark energy, the mass density of the universe is negative, which is telling him that something is fishy. And so then he threw in this dark energy and found out, yes, you're 99.73% sure that you need something like dark energy to see his observations. And so this is the other view of science. One is the CMS detector with that industrial scale. Here's somebody's lab book, what they were doodling with, trying to figure out what they were seeing. Now, this dark energy right now, we don't understand it one bit. It could be something that Einstein predicted called a cosmological constant. It could be something else entirely different. We don't know what it is. The only thing we know is that it pervades the universe and seems to be leading to an acceleration of the expansion of the universe. And so Shakespeare really had it right when he said that there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. So there's actually a proposal now before NASA and the Department of Energy to fund a space mission called JDEM, the Joint Dark Energy Mission. This will be a satellite that will, again, go up to map the sky, to map the heavens, in order to get a better handle on this expansion history. We'd like to know, for example, is the amount of dark energy a constant in time? Is it changing? What can we tell about its properties? And this dark energy mission is scheduled to be launched about 2015. And one of the key players is Chuck Bennett, who is the PI of WMAP, who's also, as I said, from Johns Hopkins. And here's an artist's conception of what the telescope would look like. And so now we have basically the ingredients then to understand the history of the universe. This picture is too hard again to see from the back of the room. But I can show you that it's 13.7 billion years long from a Big Bang to the present. 100,000 years after the Big Bang, the photons were released from the recombination, from the formation of atoms in the cooling history of the universe. Those are the photons that the WMAP is seeing today. There was a while there where the universe was dark because there was nothing going on. Stars hadn't formed yet. What was happening is the matter was collapsing, clumping. The cool areas on the WMAP picture basically are areas with less energy, more stuff. Things fell into those cool areas and nucleated stars, galaxies. And then at about 400 million years after the Big Bang, the first stars turned on. And from then, the stars have evolved to the present. What we also see is that planets formed somewhere in the middle here, maybe 5 billion years ago. What we're seeing today is the expansion accelerating from the presence of the dark energy. And these all, I think, should be explained at the Rose Center as well today. So my conclusion, I'd just like to leave you with a notion that we're really living in a very, very privileged time in the history, really, of humanity. Because it's a time in which we are, for the first time, being able to understand the cosmological history of our universe. Physics and astronomy are both playing a role. We are really beginning to understand the shape of things to come. Thank you. Question? Yeah, so I don't know. We don't know. Because time itself was created in the Big Bang. There's no way to answer that question scientifically. Please.
The problem may be our orientation. We're light-oriented, but our physiology and anatomy were dark matter and dark energy-oriented. Maybe we'd be perceptive of that and not perceptive of light.
Absolutely. Our eyes see light. They don't see the weak nuclear force, for example. Completely correct. Actually, what you raise is a very good question, because right now the technology is coming available, again, over the next 20 or 30 years, to actually image planets around different distant stars. Just last week, I believe you probably saw in the paper, the first Earth-sized planet has actually been detected around a distant star. We'll soon be able to actually take the spectra of what the light looks like that is reflected off of those planets. How would you know if light's there by looking at a planet? Life is there. How would you know? We know what Earth looks like, but there's no guarantee that life on another planet looks like life on Earth. So how would you even know? So again, you're right. We have an anthropomorphic view, and we have to break free from that. Please.
I want to ask you about this number, 13.7 billion. Has that changed recently? Because I seem to remember a number about 10 or 12 years ago in an oceanography book of 4.6 billion years.
So the Earth is about that old, 4.6 billion. This is for the universe. But even that number has the age of the universe had bounced around. There was controversies about its age, which have just been settled recently. You had a question. So again, what caused the Big Bang is very similar to what was going on before the Big Bang. And you can't trick me into trying to answer that question. I don't know. All we can do is take our present knowledge and extrapolate backwards and to see that the universe then shrinks to a point. And what happens before? What caused? I can't answer that. You guys both asked questions already. Both of you, excuse me. You had a question?
What do we imagine the Big Bang exploded into?
So the question is, what did the Big Bang explode into? And again, that is a very difficult question to answer, because we're thinking of it in terms of something expanding in this room, for example. But what was really happening was that space and time itself were created, and so they themselves are just simply expanding. What's happening is the distance between every single star, every single planet is expanding as the universe itself stretches. So it's more like an infinite piece of rubber that you're stretching. So it's not going anywhere, but it's getting stretched at the same time. So imagine an infinite piece of rubber, and it keeps getting stretched. I told you it was going to challenge the imagination. Yes.
Didn't CERN actually start up last
yes,
fall?
Yes. CERN started up with great hoopla last fall. They ran for a couple weeks and then had a real important disaster. This is a superconducting magnet. It's about a couple degrees above absolute zero, and one of the magnets quenched because of a faulty weld. And it damaged quite a few magnets. It failed in a way that hadn't been anticipated. So CERN, the accelerator, will be starting up again this fall after the repairs have been made. Repairing it didn't take so long, but designing a system to assure that this unforeseen event will never happen again is what took the extra year.
Did they learn anything, though, from some brief period of operation, or it just never got that far?
Never got going. Never got going enough to see that. Either question.
Could you talk a little bit about that picture of the baby universe, the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Background,
yeah, so with this picture here, I've lost it. Well, the picture was the one with all the dots on it, and what we see here is, this one. So that actually is a picture of the sky looking out, just like the globe of the Earth being projected onto a flat piece of paper in a particular projection. The Milky Way, our galaxy, actually splits through here and has been removed. And this is a picture where the blue areas are cool and the red areas are hot, but we're just looking at little fluctuations of one part in 10 million off this base temperature of about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So the whole picture of the universe, this is like north and south and the plane of the Milky Way, is the same temperature, about 2 degrees above absolute zero, except some parts are a tiny bit hotter and some parts are a tiny bit colder. And those fluctuations were caused by something before the photons were released. But the important point is these little cold areas are a little denser, so they've got a little more stuff in them, and so they themselves actually become seeds for galaxies as more stuff is attracted into the dense areas, leaving the light areas. So it's actually a little unstable, and the dark areas then all grew up in later life and became galaxies containing stars and planets. And so this is really the very prototypical, the very seeds of that galaxy formation that you're seeing here. Dark blue is cold and red is hot. Here's another question.
Why are they worried about antimatter collecting matter when they create this CERN accelerator? What was all that lawsuit about? The universe being destroyed and Star Trek?
Well, the question was whether the Large Hadron Collider, since it's 10 times the energy of today's collider, whether something catastrophic could happen. And people were worried that black holes would be produced and that these black holes would then swallow up the Earth and the universe. And that's not going to happen. Please. You're absolutely right. The black holes that would have been produced would have been very, very tiny black holes.
And also, it was that huge blue, almost purple area in the center, the big rose cluster.
So the question is, why is there this big dark area in the middle? And if there is, what did it grow up and become in its later life? And unfortunately, I'm not an astronomer, so I don't know the names of these things. And so I actually don't know what that dark thing is called today. And people have asked about why is there such a cold area. So that's good eyes. And your question about the black holes was right on, because the black holes, if you could make black holes at the LHC, they would be tiny black holes. But what people were worried about is that these tiny black holes would be at rest, because you have two beams that come in like this, and so the black holes wouldn't move anywhere. It would just sit there and gradually suck the Earth in. So even though it was small, it would grow up and become a problem. That was the worry.
I think on that note, we're going to have to stop you. I'm sorry. We have to go over to the actual planetarium today. And I want if you could join me in thanking Professor Daggett.